I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. A new chapter opens in the endless Middle East war with new contradictions. President Obama calls the war on ISIS an air war. His generals say it'll take boots on the ground. The people seem to say you got to do something, maybe not a war, but you got to do something when grisly executions of Americans in the desert are popping up on YouTube. Fighting those ISIS crazies crosses a lot of lines that we've been taught. It means Assad must stay for a while, the Syrian thug-in-chief who we said had to go when he was sarin-gassing his own people. Now we're told the killer fanatics in ISIS may be worse than the killer regime in Syria. Too bad also that against ISIS we will be fighting alongside Shiite Iran, not our best friend, and will be up against the Sunni forces of ISIS who have been funded all along by our chummy oil sheikhs in Saudi Arabia. Seems beyond understanding, but could the war possibly be worth fighting? On Boston Common today, we sampled people's views in our hometown.
I think that this country has to band together with all the other countries and stand up for what's right and for freedom.
I like to hear some more Muslim countries stand up and say some things about this.
Well, I just think they should be very careful because sometimes when you arm a rebel, it ends up in the wrong hands at some point.
Arming the rebels was something we had an option to do a long time ago. Unfortunately, we need Assad, we need Iran, and we're not friends with anybody, and we're also not very adept at negotiating this.
The United States left Iraq in 2011. We should have left behind a deterrent force, like we did in Germany and Japan and Korea after all those wars. We dropped the ball.
Well, you know, we put so much American lives and treasure money into Iraq for the last 10 years. I hate to see all that go by the wayside.
I feel that we're spending too much money on our military, and we should kind of just step back and see what other countries can do before we step in.
The Islamic State, they're downright scary, worse than Al-Qaeda.
They're bad boys. When the Ayatollah of Iran calls them bad, you know they've got to be bad.
It seems like all spectrums, you know, Democrats, Republicans all agree it's a big threat, but how do you deal with it?
Those were Bostonians on the Common today. We begin with John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago, perhaps the most eminent of the so-called realist students of war and peace politics. He has made waves recently in the magazine Foreign Affairs and in the New York Times, talking down the threat to America from anything that happens in Ukraine. And he doesn't see a threat to us coming from ISIS either. We're also asked the scholar Asad Abu Khalil in California, the angry Arab of the blogosphere, to unmask what looks like a proxy war over ISIS between the rival giants of oil power and Islamic culture, that is, between Shia Iran and Sunni Saudi Arabia of the militant Wahhabi persuasion. Is that what we're getting into? And we'll also ask Professor Hugh Roberts of Tufts University, and a long career in Arab politics, for a way out of it all. John Mearsheimer, where are we going here? Welcome.
Well, it appears that Barack Obama is about to take us into another war. Since the Cold War ended in 1989, the United States has fought six different wars. We've been at war for two out of every 3 years since the Cold War ended. We have an abysmal track record in those wars. If you just look what happened in Iraq between 2003 and 2011, you look at what's going on in Afghanistan and you look at what's going on in Libya, how can you be confident that the United States could win another war? Mm. But lo and behold, we're going into another one.
President Obama is the fourth in a row U.S. president, starting with George H.W. Bush, to go on national television and announce a bombing campaign in Iraq. I mean, we've seen this movie before, it seems. How does it end, John Mearsheimer?
It's very hard to tell how it ends. I mean, the goal here, according to President Obama, is to destroy or eliminate ISIS. I don't see how he's going to do that. It's hard to see what the military strategy is that's going to allow him to achieve that incredibly ambitious goal. My view, by the way, is that not only do we not have a strategy to win the war, by intervening in the fight against ISIS, we're going to make matters worse. We're going to make a bad situation worse. I believe that the jihadis, the ISIS people are glad that the United States is getting involved. And they're glad that the United States is getting involved because that's going to allow them to recruit more people. It's going to make them more popular in the Arab and Islamic world. And furthermore, what it's going to do for our so-called allies in the region is give them an incentive to sit on the sidelines and let us do the dirty work. What we should have done here, if we were smart, and of course the United States is never smart these days, is we would have stayed out of the way and let the locals deal with the problem. It's the locals who are much more threatened by ISIS than we are. They therefore would have had great incentives to work together to deal with ISIS if we weren't there to pull their chestnuts out of the fire.
But which locals either have the troops or the inclination? I mean, one immediately thinks Jordan, and then who?
Well, there are a handful of countries in the region, Egypt, Turkey, and Jordan, three of our allies in that area, have shown remarkably little interest in helping us. They're perfectly willing to let us do all the heavy lifting by ourselves. But if we weren't doing the heavy lifting, Egypt, Turkey, and Jordan would have very powerful incentives to get involved. Furthermore, there's Iran and Syria. We won't work with Iran and Syria, but in fact, Iran and Syria are probably the two best allies we could have in this fight. But again, we won't work with them. So you can see what a discombobulated strategy this is from the start.
John, come back to the notion that that ISIS deliberately provokes our entry. Certainly the media strategy of just disgusting, appalling, vivid, YouTube, well-produced documentaries of gruesome murders suggests that they might be doing it, but why? What's their hope of bringing us in?
Well, they understand full well that the United States is very unpopular in the Middle East. And when the United States comes in with military force, it uses it invariably in a blunt fashion, and it ends up killing lots of civilians and causing lots of damage. This inflames public opinion in large sectors of the Arab and Islamic world, and it makes it look like the United States is a bully, and it makes it look like the United States is at war with the Islamic world. This causes all sorts of people to flock to the side of ISIS and to help ISIS. It would be much better if we just left ISIS alone and we let the local powers deal with it.
Barack Obama got the presidential nomination in 2008 because he didn't step into the Iraq trap. What's happened in his own thinking?
It is remarkable, Chris, that a man who opposed the Iraq war in 2003 and got elected on the platform that he was going to get us out of Iraq and keep us out of Iraq is now taking us back in. And what makes it especially remarkable is that ISIS is not a serious threat. Indeed, he effectively said that in his speech the other night, that ISIS is not an immediate threat. It might be a threat down the road, and we want to nip it in the bud. But the idea that this is some sort of great threat that the United States has to worry about is, in my opinion, ludicrous. And the public discourse on this whole subject of the ISIS threat is, as Daniel Benjamin, the former State Department counterterrorism expert, said, a farce. But anyway,
they've been on a terrific roll and a scary bunch of headlines and videos. What are the limits to their expansion?
The limits to their expansion are very great. You're talking about 30,000 people who are in the process of conquering a huge swath of territory, and then they're going to have to administer or govern that territory, and that's going to be a remarkably difficult task. The idea that they're going to roll over other countries in the region is not the case. And furthermore, even if they ran over a country or two, they're not a threat to the United States. And if the United States just left them alone, they would even be less of a threat.
John Mearsheimer, make what you can of the Senate vote. 78 in favor of helping the resistance, it's put. 78 in favor, 22 against, a lopsided vote. But interestingly, the presidential class, shall we say, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul among the Republicans, Elizabeth Warren, Sherrod Brown among the Democrats, for example, all voted no. Decipher that.
Well, I think they're very worried that this war is going to go south and they're going to be blamed for having voted for it. That's my sense.
But what about the 3-1 majority voting for?
Well, we've had this public discourse in the country over the past few months about ISIS that has created this widespread belief that we're dealing with the second coming of the Third Reich. And if we don't stop the new Wehrmacht now, they'll be on the beaches of Long Island before we know it.
We always say that.
We always say that.
The beaches of California in Vietnam, but go ahead.
Yes, I mean, you remember those arguments. And we lost in Vietnam, and it made zero difference on our position in the world. And in fact, 14 years later, we emerged as the most powerful state on the planet when the Cold War ended. The fact is, the United States is a remarkably secure country. It's the most secure country in the history of the modern world, and it's in large part for geographical reasons. And we are now today more safe than we have ever been. We're separated from the rest of the world by two giant moats, the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. We have thousands of nuclear weapons, and we live in a unipolar world, which means, by definition, we're the only great power in the world.
But we don't feel that way anyway anymore since 9/11. Let's be real.
No, we don't feel that way anymore because we have this huge national security establishment that generates all sorts of threat inflation, and we have a media that's consumed with talking about these issues in ways that make it look like there's a threat under every rock. And the end result is it's very easy to scare the American people and to get them to go off on these escapades that are completely unnecessary and which we lose anyway.
What if Barack Obama is in fact more interested in degrading than destroying ISIS and in fact has a very limited war in mind?
Well, I'm sure he would like to degrade, and I'm sure he would like to make the war limited. But I wish him good luck, because it's going to drag on and on. And even if he weakens these guys, new people will appear to cause trouble someplace else.
Coming up, there are conflicts of interest and ideology and religion in the Arab and Muslim world around this ISIS war. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with John Mearsheimer in Chicago, and Hugh Roberts of Tufts University in our Boston studio, and the Lebanese scholar Asad Abu Khalil in California. We are bracing for the ISIS phase of the now 35-year-old U.S. war for the Middle East. Earlier this week, I spoke with the esteemed Irish-English journalist Patrick Coburn, who has been in and out of Middle East war zones for 35 years. He was perhaps the first to write clearly the trends that few reporters saw coming. For example, that the detested Assad regime in Syria was not about to be dislodged. Also, that even last year, Sunni resistance under the ISIS flag was reinforcing itself with fanaticism and considerable military skill in Iraq and Syria at the same time. Also, he noted that Saudi Arabia has been the real sponsor of ISIS from the start.
I became very conscious last year of how the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant ISIS was becoming stronger and stronger in Iraq. They'd captured Abu Ghraib prison in the middle of last summer. They'd freed a lot of their militants then. I became conscious of how weak the government was, how corrupt it was in Baghdad, how the Sunni community as a whole was getting more and more alienated, and that protest meetings and peaceful opposition were transmuting into armed resistance. And as the year went on, those processes seemed to be moving towards even more violence. I mean, there was another strand in this that I'd been quite a lot in Syria. It was evident that the jihadis were taking over the opposition. And above all, and this is one point that I'd sort of wanted to stress in the book and why I came to write it, that this was destabilizing Iraq. I think this is where the U.S. and the others are most culpable, that they allowed that to happen. I was still pretty shaken when, on the 10th of June, they captured Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, with a few thousand men. There are 350,000 men in the Iraqi army. There were meant to be 30,000 soldiers in Mosul. You know, this is unprecedented. I can't think of any other defeat in history when such a large, well-equipped force was defeated and routed by one that was so small and ill-equipped.
So how's to explain it?
I think this sort of chilling mixture of extraordinary religious fanaticism and military expertise. The military expertise, people sometimes say it's officers from Saddam's time.
Yes.
But remember, Saddam's army wasn't that efficient. And I think it's, you know, if you have people in Al-Qaeda who are fighting the U.S. troops in Iraq for years, and later they're fighting in Syria against the Syrian army and others, and they've survived, they're probably pretty good at their jobs. They're probably pretty effective fighters.
That was the journalist Patrick Coburn, who writes for The Independent and the London Review of Books. His concise little book on all of this is titled The Jihadis Return, ISIS, and the New Sunni Uprising. Asad Abu Khalil wrote The Battle for Saudi Arabia, Royalty, Fundamentalism, and Global Power. He teaches politics at Cal State Stanislaus, and he blogs at Angry Arab News Service. Welcome, Professor Abu Khalil.
Thank you.
I want you to help us understand the Saudi piece inside ISIS, behind ISIS, and in Washington, too.
Right. I mean, I think it would be more accurate to say that there are many layers of proxy wars that have been going on in Syria for the last 3 years. I think the United States has not been a bystander. What we have done 3 years ago is that we assumed, wrongly of course, that Bashar al-Assad was about to be overthrown. As a result, we signaled, we made it very clear to our client states of Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia that they can go ahead, arm, and finance the so-called Syrian rebels. And then the media, just as they did back in the 80s about the Afghan Mujahideen, started a mythology and romanticization of a fanatical band of Islamist international coming to Syria from around the world. And they basically presented an image to the American public that these are some moderate liberals under the name, fictitious name, of a free Syrian army that doesn't really exist on the ground in order to justify the American project. Hmm. I mean, the Congress is still subscribing to this mythology by this generous $500 million that was extended to the so-called Syrian rebels. What was happening in Syria 3 years ago is basically a multiplicity of proxy wars. You have, on the one hand, Qatar and Saudi Arabia fighting it out. Each one is trying to get for his side a niche of the Islamist fundamentalist global war.
Okay.
Qatar is a sponsor of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis are the sponsors of the Salafis, the more militant brand of political Islam. I mean, the United States, of course, was supporting both of these states in their wars inside Syria. Turkey was on the side of Qatar. You have on the other side a Sunni Shiite war. The United States and Saudi Arabia and other client states have been part of a bitter, vicious Sunni-Shiite war. The United States and Israel assume this is the best way in order to undermine the credential of a Lebanese resistance movement that is predominantly Shiite. So they wanted to divert the attention and enmity of the Arabs, supposedly, from Israel to Iran. And at the third level, you have the competition between Iran and Israel that is going on in Syria. Israel calculated that by bringing down the Syrian regime, then the Iranian and the Hezbollah would be at a great disadvantage. Let us not forget the Israeli lobby and the Saudi lobby, and John Mesharmer, of course, knows and wrote a lot about that, are quite active in Washington, D.C., and they have been quite instrumental in this generous funding of the so-called Syrian rebels. There is yet another level of a proxy war in Syria, and that is a global war between Russia and the United States, just like in the Ukraine, just like in Syria, for influence. So it's not that the United States was like not totally isolated of what's happening, and suddenly there were YouTube videos, and the United States was appalled and decided out of humanitarian intervention to intervene. Just like John Mesheimer has said, I mean, there is no argument that has been made, certainly not persuasively, that ISIS poses any threat to the United States. Now, having said that, after the last 2 weeks of some 160-odd bombing raids into Iraq on their bases, we are going to make sure to turn them into our enemies, and by that, we could turn them into another al-Qaeda. And let us remember that the agenda of ISIS is also in competition with the original al-Qaeda, and that is operating in Syria as Nusra Front. The irony of all this that is missing to the American public is that in Syria today, we are on the side of the original al-Qaeda against ISIS. So this is not a pretty war of moderates versus extremists. These are extremists on both sides.
I wish you'd explain it in terms of one fascinating figure that seems to play every side against all the others, and that's the Prince Bandar, referred to in the Arab press, I see, is Bandar, Prince of Jihad. He was George Bush's best friend. He heard about the Iraqi invasion before Colin Powell did. A great salon keeper and friend of everybody in Washington. And formerly the chief of intelligence for the Saudi government in the last few years, and openly funding ISIS and the jihadis in Syria. It was taken to be his way of competing with Iran, fighting for the soul and spirit of true Islam. And yet he was yanked from his job a few months ago. What does this tell us?
Well, I mean, I think that the United States belatedly realized that relying on Saudi Arabia to run the show in Syria has been one of the dumbest things that the Obama administration has done, among many other dumb things in the Middle East region. And that is when the chief of intelligence was replaced. But it's not only about Bandar. As I suggested, that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are in a very bitter rivalry in the Middle East region, trying to inherit the political mantle, so to speak, after the so-called ill-named Arab Spring. And what they realize is that it is not as easy as they assumed in Syria, that the days of Bashar, as Hillary Clinton kept saying 3 years ago, are not numbered. In fact, it could be that America's influence and the influence of its allies are the ones who are numbered. The United States has unwittingly, in fact, boosted the credibility and standing of the repressive regime of Bashar al-Assad by producing these monsters on the other side. I mean, as you said, this is a movie that has been repeated, not only in Afghanistan. Look what we've done in Libya. The United States, in the name of all these lofty ideals and humanitarian intervention discourse, started a terrible war in Libya. And then, typically, like we did in Afghanistan, we pack and leave, leaving gangs and terrorists to fight it out in the street of Libya and terrorize the population. And there is going to be a monster coming out of Libya, and they will hit the United States eventually. That is the illogic of our military intervention from Afghanistan to Libya and now in Syria. And for that reason, I share the very pessimistic view of John Mersheimer. And I also remember the words that were said by Robert Gates, of all people, towards the end of the Bush administration, when he said, any future American president who considers sending U.S. troops yet again to the Middle East has to have his head examined. And it seems to me, Obama, who labeled George Bush's war in Iraq as a dumb war, may be starting a far dumber war that we are now entering. And the end is not in sight.
I want to ask you sort of the big question about Saudi Arabia. And it, for some reason or other, doesn't get asked. But basically, holding Saudi Arabia responsible in some fashion, going back to 9/11. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. Important Saudis were spirited out of this country overnight without explanation. 28 pages of the official inquiry on 9/11 dealing with Saudi Arabia are still missing, unpublishable. I mean, it sounds like a tail wagging the dog sort of thing, except I'm unclear whether Saudi Arabia is the dog or the tail. I mean, how does Prince Bandar get away with all this?
Well, I mean, I don't want to personalize it. I mean, this is a Saudi regime. And let us remember that since FDR, every single American administration has been a very close ally of the Saudi royal family. I refuse to reduce it into a friendship between the Bush family and the Saudi royal family, as sometimes is done in the media. It's well beyond that. Obama, in the first act of his administration, literally bowed down to the Saudi king. I mean, this is one of the Faustian alliances we have had since the end of the Second World War. Saudi Arabia is, as is known, or as is not known, because American press is quite oblivious on purpose to the human rights violation over there, is one of the worst violators of human rights around the world. I mean, they are the inspiration of ISIS. What is missing from this dialogue is that we are relying on the regime that shares the very ideology of ISIS in order to defeat ISIS. I mean, there is something paradoxical about this. Saudi Arabia is the mother father of all these militant fanatical ideology. It is the ideology of Wahhabiyya, which is shared by ISIS. It is shared by Al-Qaeda as a mother organization. And it's also shared by the various criminal gangs that are running amok in Syria today. And Saudi Arabia this year alone has beheaded 53 men and women, and yet this is not in the news. Some of them
they don't put it on YouTube. But I want you know too much about this whole thing, Professor Abu Khalil. I want John Mearsheimer to just review what you're saying. Specifically, the Saudi regime is the banker of ISIS. Their inescapable friend in the Gulf, but they're backing our new enemy in Syria and Iraq. How can this be? Can you explain it?
Well, I think you can explain it by the fact that Saudi Arabia is a Sunni state, and the Sunnis have been persecuted in Iraq by the Shia regime. And ISIS is a Sunni organization, and it's not surprising, especially as Professor Abu Khalil said, given the ideological similarities. There's not complete overlap by any means, but there are ideological similarities. It was easy for Saudi Arabia to support ISIS and to support the Sunnis in Iraq. And, of course, one of the reasons that ISIS has been so successful is that the Sunnis, who feel persecuted by the Shia-led regime in Baghdad, have been willing to, in effect, ally themselves with ISIS and help ISIS win. And this is why the Obama administration, by the way, is pushing the regime in Baghdad to be much more generous in its treatment of the Sunnis so that it can peel the Sunnis away, the Iraqi Sunnis away from supporting ISIS. But I think a lot of it just has to do with Sunni-Shia divide.
Did the Obama administration get Prince Bandar fired? Is he really out of the action? Have we changed that policy of supporting ISIS, the Saudi policy?
I have no idea how to answer that question. That's outside my area of expertise.
Professor Abu Khalil, John Mearsheimer
You seem to be interested in Prince Bandar. I assure you that he's not out of the picture. And in recent official meetings in Saudi Arabia, he has been visible in the Saudi press in pictures sitting right beside this foreign minister. So, I mean, it's not the idiosyncrasies of Prince Bandar that are driving Saudi foreign policy.
But
it's collective wisdom or lack of wisdom of the royal family itself.
Do these interests ever collide? Are they ever getting recognized in the conversations between the United States and Saudi Arabia about ISIS?
Sure. I think this is exactly what happened. My own take about the sudden realization by Saudi Arabia that there is a danger from ISIS is, in fact, driven by American pressure. You have to understand, Saudi lobby in Washington, D.C. is quite powerful, especially since in the last decade there has been a very close alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel. So the lobby itself of Saudi Arabia has become an appendage of the Israeli lobby, and that's how they move things in Washington. The Americans, in the last 6 months or so, came to the realization the Syrian rebels are now posing a direct threat to America's interests in the Middle East, that the Syrian rebels are not as moderate, as well-groomed as Saudi intelligence has promised them that they will do. And because of that, they put direct pressure on the Saudis to try to reverse course. And what's happened in the negotiation between the Americans and their allies is that the Qataris blame the Saudis and the Saudis blame the Qatari. And if you ask me, I think both of them are complicit. Both of them were far too generous in cash and in arms. And we don't know about Americans' covert operations and training for the rebels as well in helping the rebels. And as a result, who are the ones who are being recruited for the cause in Syria? These are not secular feminists, as we were led to believe. These were the most fanatical people, the same kind of people who were inspired to pack their bags from all over the world and go fight the communists in Afghanistan. It's a very similar scenario.
Do we understand how the war develops and comes to an end? Professor Abu Khalil, John Mearsheimer thinks it'll be yet another embarrassment for the United States.
Without a doubt. I see this as being well beyond the debacle of the war in Iraq of the Bush administration. You see, in the Iraq war, I mean, of course, the George W. Bush administration thought it's going to be a quick one. They thought the same about Afghanistan and were dragged on. You know, the American administration later withdrew the troops, and we will be withdrawing troops from Afghanistan as well. But this one is different because it has no particular border. ISIS is expanding beyond the confines of Iraq. They have different cells in different Middle Eastern countries. And we may be pushing them, in fact, to become an operative like Al-Qaeda in parts of the West. So as a result, I do not see how this administration or the next one, which I will predict will still be embroiled in fighting this danger of ISIS, how will they declare an end? What will they do? Because even if they leave and they will stop their bombing campaign, the tentacles of the operation and the consequences will continue to haunt the region for many years to come, especially that we are now empowering fanatics on one side to fight against fanatics on the other side. I mean, I cannot see there's a pretty outcome out of that.
We haven't seen it yet with John Mearsheimer in Chicago, Asad Abu Khalil in California, joined now by Hugh Roberts of Tufts University. He is a post-imperial Englishman who made his career studying Arab politics, especially in Egypt and North Africa and Algeria, for the International Crisis Group. Hugh Roberts, I heard you eloquently warning against an American intervention in Syria. That was a year and a half ago. What about this one?
I think I agree with much of what has been said already, that this latest war venture is almost certainly ill-conceived and will end badly if it ends at all. It could go on for a very long time, generating all kinds of dreadful fallout. I am personally pessimistic, like other speakers tonight, about the possibilities of getting Washington to rein back or to change course, to do something constructive and thought through and useful instead of this sort of manic resort to airstrikes as if they are the solution, when so much of this project clearly has not been thought through. I mean, if we just consider for one moment the evident need to put boots on the ground if ISIS is to be seriously degraded, to use President Obama's terminology, let alone destroyed. There's no way that airstrikes is going to destroy it. Airstrikes can perhaps destroy a regime based on cities, but they cannot deal effectively with a movement based in the countryside that is capable of dispersing itself very rapidly. And there aren't the boots on the ground available. It's quite clear that America will not allow its sons and daughters to be pressed into this war. And it's also pretty clear that most of the so-called Arab coalition of the willing are really a coalition of the very unwilling, the very reluctant. They're going to do the minimum. So there isn't a military formula in place for dealing with this. And short of actually changing course and changing the attitude to Damascus, changing the attitude to the Assad regime there, and changing the attitude to Tehran, the availability, I mean, serious military allies capable of joining in a militarily effectual expedition to deal with ISIS simply aren't available. I think that before suggesting what people opposed to this war should be canvassing and proposing as an alternative, I think it's always an important thing for critics of warmongering to have a serious alternative. Before suggesting elements of an alternative, I'd like to say I think that Washington has actually missed two important opportunities to change course. I think it had an opportunity to change its position on the Syrian crisis.
And a year ago it did.
No, it didn't.
But President Obama didn't bomb Syria when he said he was going to.
He didn't bomb when he said he's going to, but it didn't change the line that Washington policy was to secure regime change in Syria at the Assad's expense. The point is that when the whole question of chemical weapons blew up and Russia made its extremely ingenious and constructive intervention to secure Damascus's agreement to handing over all its chemical weapons, that was an opportunity for Washington to change its line on the question of regime change, because it didn't take it. Its position today is that it's still not prepared to come to terms with Assad, even though all the evidence suggests his regime is going to continue indefinitely, that it cannot be overthrown by internal forces. And that means that Washington is denying itself a serious military ally against ISIS. And I think that the second opportunity is one it's just missed, given that the spectacular expansion of ISIS into northern Iraq and the capture of Mosul last June, and the element of hysteria generated by, of course, these spectacular and grotesque executions of American journalists and now a British aid worker, this was actually also at least a half a jar open window of opportunity for Washington to change its line in relation to Syria, and it's refused to do so. Now, the question is, we could discuss why, but let me suggest that elements of a different approach have to be proposed in opposition to what Washington under the present administration seems to be determined to do. And I'd like to suggest that to sort of cut to the chase, it seemed Please. To me for quite a long time that the Middle East has been so riven by conflicts over the last 25 years, 24 years since the first war against Iraq in 1990-1991. The Sunni-Shia division has been so massively envenomed over the last decade in the wake of the overthrow of the Saddam regime in Iraq and therefore the increase of Shia power in Iraq at the expense, in geopolitical terms, of the Sunni Gulf states. All this has been so envenomed that it's been quite clear for some time, in my view, that the Middle East as a whole needs a new negotiated regional security system. And this is something that when we think about what America does, this is something that America, that after all pretends to a position of unparalleled leadership in the world, has been signally failing to provide.
That's just what I've been thinking, in the sense that, you know, the Middle East was shaped by imperial powers after World War I and not in the Arab or the locals' interest. I'd love to imagine and hear you three on a Middle East version of the Treaty of Westphalia that drew up the map of Europe in 1648 and a lot of the rules to this day, or the Congress of Vienna after the Napoleonic Wars, or the Congress of Versailles 2.0. Can you imagine such a rearrangement? Remapping, rethinking, reconnecting, maybe revival of the Ottoman Empire, you know, with a network, but a local governorships, could work.
Could I suggest that a crucial thing that needs to be put into reverse is this appalling poisoning of the Sunni-Shia religious division? One should bear in mind that...
That's going to be rebalanced too.
If I could just explain...
Please.
What we're seeing in this terrible, violent, vicious sectarianism is not a tradition. There has long been, of course, this religious difference. But Saudi Arabia, as the protectors of the holy shrines, have long accepted the right of Shias to make the pilgrimage to Mecca in peace. And what we're looking at, in other words, is something that has developed over the last decade. And it's developed to a considerable extent because of the fear of Saudi Arabia and the other Sunni Gulf kingdoms about the increase in Iranian power in the region since the overthrow of the Saddam Hussein regime, the Ba'athist regime in Baghdad, and the failure of America and the other Western powers to secure a resolution of the question mark over the nuclear development program of Iran. And given that the military option was ruled out 18 months ago by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, after, of course, a long controversy about whether there's going to be war against Iran or not. Given that military solution was ruled out 18 months ago, it's been quite clear to me, and I think it must have been clear to some other people thinking about this, that only a political solution was available. That solution would only work and would only reassure Saudi Arabia and other Sunni states if it was accompanied by genuine guarantees as part of a broader security system. And in particular, there would be a need for external guarantees, America being one of them. But the other external guarantee that was almost certainly necessary from Iran's point of view was Russia. The point is, Russia has been available to play a constructive role in the Middle East, and Washington, backed here by London and Paris, have consistently refused to allow Russia to play a constructive role. And we've seen over the blow-up of the crisis over Ukraine, clearly a push coming from the Western capitals to return to a Cold War situation at Russia's expense. This means that what the Western powers are doing are denying themselves political options for resolving major elements of the crisis in the Middle East. This is willful, and it's the wrong policy, and people need to begin to understand that and counter it.
John Mearsheimer, what would it take to establish some sort of regional security system, new rules, maybe new maps, as Hugh Roberts is suggesting?
Well, I am in favor of reaching agreements with different countries in the region, and everything he said about U.S.-Iranian relations and how to deal with the Russians, I agree with. But I don't like your idea of some sort of Congress, something along the lines of the Treaty of Westphalia. And
that was
the reason
my idea.
I don't like it. The reason I don't like it is because you're implying in your commentary that this should be led by the United States. You talked about...
No, I didn't mean that, but go ahead.
Well, if the United States is not involved and the local powers figure it out for themselves, that's fine by me. I'm a big believer in self-determination, and I think one of the principal problems that the United States has faced for many decades now is that it likes to stick its nose in everybody's business. The United States thinks it has both a right and a responsibility to tell people in different countries around the world what kind of political system they should have, what kind of foreign policy they should have, and this has got us into all sorts of trouble. My view is let people in the region figure out their own politics, let them shape the region as they see fit, and keep us out. The other reason you want to keep us out is not simply because of self-determination, but also because the United States has the Midas touch in reverse. Anything it touches turns into a disaster. So the idea that you're going to send these geniuses in Washington over there to fix this problem is delusional. If you put the United States in the middle of the process, it'll just make things much worse. So I'm in favor of a Congress if that Congress is run by the locals and we stay out.
No, I would, well, first, Professor Abu Khalil, why don't you convene the Congress? You can.
Well, I mean, I also agree. I think if there is anything the region of the Middle East needs and desires, it is a lack of American intervention of any kind. The American administration always tries to justify its intervention by references to invocation and calls for its role in the Middle East region without telling the American audience that the only ones who are clamoring for America's roles and wars are the Gulf potentates, and these are not representative of the people of the Middle East. I think by virtue of self-determination, then we can have an arrangement that's secure and stable. But the United States, I mean, it's not that the United States is making a mistake. The United States is deliberately obstructing any manifestations of self-determination in the region. Look what happened in Egypt. In Egypt, the people decided to roll over a dictatorship that the United States constructed in the service of the State of Israel back in 1979. And when the people of Egypt voted in the most democratic election ever in Egyptian history, what did we do? We allowed an American-trained general to reverse the election and to launch a coup, and now we are doing business with that person. Not only that, we're relying on him to help us out in the mess in Iraq. And of course, he's not going to play any role. He could hardly deal with the radicals and the militant in the Sinai Peninsula. So, I mean, it's all a fantasy about what we can accomplish. I think the Middle East will eventually have a secure, stable arrangement, but when Western intervention is basically eliminated. And when we speak about the very dangerous Sunni-Shiite war, which is reaching unprecedented level in the history of Islam, basically, this also was not accidental. I mean, I come from a mixed marriage. My mother was Sunni, my father was Shiite. These things were not uncommon back in the 1950s. Saudi Arabia, with close coordination with the United States, decided to start a very sectarian pitch back in 2003, and they reconstructed Iraq along sectarian lines, which started all this mess. This wasn't an accident. It was on purpose. So the urgency is...
On whose purpose? On whose purpose? Remind me.
I'm sorry?
On whose purpose? Remind me.
For the purpose of our clients in Saudi Arabia and those regions. We want them to be scared of Iran. I mean, I'm not somebody who really buys that Saudi regime is really that scared of Iran. But instead of saying to the region that Israel is really unhappy with Iranian nuclear weapons or any weapons of any kind, we would like to tell the Arabs and the Muslim, well, it's not Israel that's really scared. It's the Muslims of Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Bahrain and those potentates.
You know, start with Sykes-Picot. I mean, it made Lawrence of Arabia made it famous, and the movie made it a world sort of joke. Who is to say... Okay, it was a mistake, the whole map. Start again, and you guys work it out from the ground up. Hugh Roberts.
Well, I think that's... Look, one of the worst things...
We can also blame the Brits and the French.
One of the worst things that
that Western policy wonks do, and their governments sometimes follow suit, is to think that they can just sort of wipe the board clean and draw a new pattern on it. This is a terribly arrogant attitude. It's playing God, and it's ridiculous. The point about Sykes-Picot, which of course you can criticize from all kinds of points of view, is that it, in a way, forced the various Arab populations to develop the idea of national political systems. So we get a number of distinct nationalisms developing: Syrian nationalism, Iraqi nationalism. It's interesting that the pan-Arab idea, originally subscribed by the Ba'ath, actually fades away, and we get local nationalisms, if you like. Now, what the West has done since 1990, beginning with the war in 1990-91 against Iraq, is actually make it clear that it's out to destroy nationality is a political principle in the Middle East. And when we look at the Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL or whatever we want to call it, the fact that it is proclaiming a caliphate is actually following the logic of Western behavior. Western behavior has been relentlessly opposed to the principle of nationality as the principal constitutive of states in the Middle East. It is happy to support little sheikdoms in the Gulf, which are not nation states. But the serious nation states, Iraq, Syria, and so on, have been subverted. The ideal is clearly to preserve the general map inherited from the Sykes-Picot era while reducing regimes to mere clients. And what we're really seeing here in operation is, in effect, the globalization of the Monroe Doctrine, with all that meant for Latin American states, clientelized and under the thumb of the U.S., now being, in a way that, in my view, is lunatic, being attempted across the world, with the Middle East in particular, in the front rank. Now, the point is that what that means is that there's a logic to the demand for a caliphate. The idea that these people, they may not be in earnest about it, the Islamic State, but the point is that their proclamation of this is part of their attraction. We should remember that it's a demand that has been there since the end of the Ottoman Empire, the restoration of the caliphate. And if it's now Western policy to ensure that doesn't happen, the West is running out of options if it is continuing to deny, as other speakers have said, the principle of self-determination.
John Mearsheimer on the caliphate. On the Hugh Roberts blessed caliphate.
Well, I think that the word caliphate is really a rhetorical device. I think that if ISIS ends up controlling the territory that it now inhabits for any appreciable period of time, it will be a state. And like any other state in the region, it will have to administer the people who live in that state, and it will have to deal with its neighbors. I think the idea that you're going to have some caliphate that looks different from the nation states or the states we have in the Middle East and all over the world is not realistic. I think if you look at the globe today, what's really remarkable is how homogeneous it is, how the globe is just divided among different kinds of states. And all ISIS is an Islamic state. It can call itself a caliphate, but it's not a special threat because it calls itself that. But I don't think in the end there's that much difference between ISIS and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia can call itself a caliphate, but it's still a Saudi state, and this will be an Islamic state.
Do you see a way out for the United States, John Mearsheimer, in 30 seconds?
No, I don't see a way out. I think we're getting deeper and deeper, and I think it's categorically depressing. The fact that this is just another war in Iraq is hard to believe. We have no good reason to be fighting ISIS. We have no strategy for beating them. And if you look carefully, I think we're going to make matters worse.
Thank you, John Mearsheimer. Thank you, Asad Abu Khalil. Thank you, Hugh Roberts. Thanks also to Patrick Coburn. There's a link to John Mearsheimer's recent piece on Ukraine in Foreign Affairs magazine on our website. There's also a timeline tracing the rise of ISIS back to its roots. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies, with help from Will Freeman and Maria Jose Fabre. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.